With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Josh Winning about his fantasy novel, The Shadow Glass. Josh is a senior film writer at Radio Times and writes about film for several other publications. Two of his many career highlights include meeting Kermit the Frog and Miss Piggy and eating breakfast with zombies on the set of The Walking Dead. In this episode, we discuss his obsession with learning about story structure, how he writes in a filmic way, and his interesting route to getting an agent. But first, here's Josh with an excerpt from The Shadow Glass.
The hall was even more cluttered than he remembered. Knick-knacks and keepsakes crowded the passage, giving the impression of a pokey antique shop. A grandfather clock stood surrounded by bone-dry potted plants, while Japanese shadow glass posters were mounted on the walls. A shelving unit groaned with VHS tapes, DVDs, a Walkman and a cassette tape library, and there were books everywhere, feathered with age and heaped amid swirling dust motes. Jack's neck creaked as he turned his head to take it all in. The curios were familiar, but also different to how he remembered them, as if he were viewing them through mottled glass. They looked decayed, relics from another time, a life he had almost forgotten he'd lived. And this was just the hall. From where he stood, he glimpsed the rooms and passages beyond, wending in a disordered muddle, combining to form a house of riddles, a place in which to get lost. He stilled, frowning at the distant point where the back hall turned into the kitchen. He was sure he'd seen movement there. He pictured his father, still roaming Ketu House, tall and narrow as a telegraph pole, shuffling in slippers and a moth-eaten cardigan, fingers scratching his beard. He could still hear the whispers of a man who had long since relinquished his grip on reality. In a forgotten time, in a forgotten world, deep within a forgotten chamber few have ever seen, the shadow glass sees all. Jack gritted his teeth and shook off the image. That was years ago. Bob was dead, and the house was empty, of anything living at least. He couldn't get distracted. Aiming for the rickety staircase, he went further inside, his fingers tapping one of the bottles in a drinks cabinet. He recalled being 14 and smashing bottles in the street, furious at his father for his latest drunken tirade. The memory stung, and even though Jack wasn't a drinker, his mouth felt parched. He uncapped the bottle, taking a defiant swig as he started up the stairs. The whiskey seared the back of his throat.
Hi, Josh. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really pleased to have you here with me today to talk about The Shadow Glass.
Hello, thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Can you start by introducing your novel and telling us the plot, please?
Yes. So the plot of The Shadow Glass, it's all about this guy called Jack Corman. He's this like directionless 30-something and the son of one-time movie director Bob Corman. In the 1980s, Bob made The Shadow Glass, which was a puppet fantasy film that bombed on release and turned him into something of an eccentric recluse, kind of ruined the relationship between Bob and his son Jack. So when Bob dies in present day, his son Jack returns to the family home to sort of see what he can sell off, basically, to get rid of his debt. And he is stunned and slightly disturbed when the puppets from his dad's film come to life in the attic, and they drag him into a real world quest involving scaly villains and a bunch of movie loving fan kids.
What a brilliant way to describe it. And it's such a treat for like 80s movies fans. And we're going to talk about your inspiration behind it. But I was wondering, obviously, it's heavily inspired by all these incredible, iconic movies. And you're clearly a huge fan. But I was wondering whether the idea was something you've been working on for a long time.
The germ of the idea was basically, I want to write about movie puppets, because I just thought that was such a great topic for a story. And I missed all of those films from the 80s that I grew up on and loved, and that real sort of like tangibility of an 80s puppet fantasy film where they're just so charming and just so entertaining. And so yeah, that was the germ of the idea, was I want to do a puppet fantasy story. But it didn't really come to life in my mind until I pivoted the attention more towards Jim Henson, who obviously was the director of Labyrinth, co-directed The Dark Crystal, best known for The Muppets. And when I discovered that he did Dark Crystal, which was sort of like met with slight bemusement by audiences and critics alike. And then he did Labyrinth, which he thought might sort of help him break through to sort of the mainstream family audience in a way that he kind of had done with the Muppets. And then that kind of essentially underperformed commercially. And the story was that he found that really difficult. You know, his son talks about how it left him heartbroken. And it took him a long time to sort of get over it. And then he sadly died sort of a couple of years later. And he never really got to see the film emerge as the cult classic, beloved cult classic that it's become. And something about that just made me feel so sort of, it was so such a bittersweet notion. And that it kind of fired up this idea of movie puppets and gave me a story to explore, really.
Yeah, I guess it gave you the kind of like emotional core of the story, really. And yeah, without absolutely. Without that, I guess it was hard to frame it as kind of just a puppet story. And it's a lot more than that in the novel.
Yeah, I think that the emotion of it was sort of like the most important part. You could have had just like a fun, silly jaunt with movie puppets, but I think it would quite quickly lose interest, maybe. Like, I think that all stories should make you feel something. And I think the reason that stories and books and movies are so popular is because people want to feel something. And I think that's the way the book came alive, was finding that emotional core. And it was Jack's relationship with his father that really kept me going and kept me motoring through the first draft and beyond.
So anyone that's been following you on Twitter will have seen you have been doing these kind of like 80s movie rewatches. And so we've already obviously mentioned that you're a huge fan and heavily inspired, but how did the movies help with the structure of the novel, or did they not help? Did they kind of distract you from the form of writing a novel?
I'm obsessed with structure. I find it like endlessly fascinating. I've read all the books, you know, I've read John York's, is it Out of the Woods or Into the Woods?
Into the Woods.
I've read that, you know, I've read various others, and it's hilarious how even the best, most complicated stories, they really do fit that very specific structure. And sometimes when I'm sort of plotting something, that can feel restrictive. And sometimes it can sort of bring on like a eureka moment, because you can reach a point and think, oh, well, where do I go from here? And if you know that this is the all is lost moment, it's great, because you can go, okay, well, what is the all is lost moment? Sort of, as we said, like emotionally in this story. And so I think that structure can really help. And movies, particularly mainstream movies, they get such a bad rap a lot of the time, I think, mainstream films. But a lot of them have structure just down to a sort of a perfect art. You can see the inciting incident, you can see the midpoint. And I do think that I've learned so much from watching movies, because you almost get this, I think everyone has it. I don't think people really realize it, but people have an innate understanding of story, because when they say, oh, this is rubbish, it's often because it's not quite hitting those structural sort of beats, I think.
Yeah.
So I was very aware of all of those incidents when I was plotting. I actually saw V.E. Schwab do a talk last week. She's obviously like a fantastic fantasy author. And she said that she really does see a movie playing in her mind. And what she's doing is transcribing it so that readers can experience the same movie. And I kind of feel exactly the same way. Like when she said that, I was like, you've just stolen that right out of my brain, V.E. Schwab. So absolutely. Movies completely sort of dictated the structure and pacing of the book.
Yeah, I was going to say to you, your book reads in such a filmic way that, very much like you were describing, I could see it playing in my head. So you've kind of answered this already, but were you transcribing that movie when you were writing it then?
Yeah, and it's frustrating when the story isn't playing ball, because you know, you can see it, you can I think you can see the feeling of it, you know what you're trying to get to, and you know that something has to happen at this point, but it's not always easy to figure out exactly what. Like there's a sequence in the second act of the book where it takes place at a fantasy convention, and I rewrote that moment. It was in somebody's house, it was in somebody else's house, it was like, you know, at a studio. And then eventually I was like, what am I doing? None of this is working. Obviously it should be at a convention. And it was like this aha moment.
Yeah.
Where what I could see, there's this phrase in yoga where they say see feelingly. And I think that when you're writing, often you see feelingly, but you can't quite figure out the specifics. I'm very pleased that it did play out like a movie, because that's what I was trying to do.
Yeah. I'm amazed to hear you say that the convention thing was a later thing that came to you, because to me it's like, it can't be anything else but a convention. Like, it's such a great set piece, you know?
I know. Sometimes you're like, what was I thinking? Why was I getting into such a, you know, often the simplest solution is the best. And I was being stupid by not just seeing that, you know, I was too busy trying to be clever and twisty and all that kind of stuff.
So we've mentioned that the emotional core of the story was something that really helped you build the novel, like put the pieces together. One of the key aspects is that relationship between parent and child, father and son, Jack and Bob. And can we say daddy issues is such a key part of 80s and 90s kind of family movies. So how did that relationship develop then? Was it always father and son? Did you always know that had to be kind of like the central conflict?
Yeah, absolutely. It was always going to be daddy issues. And I'm really glad that you said that, because I read a review.
There's nothing else. It had to be daddy issues.
I read a review where somebody said the book has a lot of daddy issues. And I was like, at first I was like, humph. But then I thought, you know what? I'm just going to bloody own that. And I put it on my infographic.
I saw, yeah.
I was like, it is about daddy issues. And that's unapologetic in the book.
I don't see that as a bad thing. But to me, that's at the heart of so many family films that I can think of. I mean, Star Wars, for God's sake, you know, daddy issues.
Absolutely. And it was only after I had actually finished the book, long after I'd finished the book, that I realized that's the case, that there are so many 80s films that are about efficient parent figures, or sort of corrupted parent figures, or kids trying to understand their parents. So even though that wasn't something I planned consciously, I think it was probably playing around in my psyche somewhere. I always think that I'm like an instinctive storyteller, which sounds like a boast, but it's not a boast, because it's actually quite annoying sometimes that you can't quite, like I was saying, can't quite get the specifics, but the instinctive stuff, I think you can sometimes question it and sort of question it and edit it out. Whereas often the instinctive stuff leads to elements that feel right rather than just being meticulously researched. I think if I'd sat down and watched sort of, you know, 20 80s fantasy films before, right before I started writing, it probably would have scared me off actually writing it, to be honest. So I didn't do that. I actively didn't do it. And I actually just wrote from my memory of my memory of those films, which I do know very well, and the way that I felt about them.
Did you go back to them when you were editing and when you were kind of trying to build it up from kind of the early drafts?
No, I didn't go back to them really until we started doing the 80s Fantasy Film Club on Twitter and Instagram. I think I was a bit scared to. I don't really know why. I think I was just very conscious of trying to make the Shadow Glass its own thing. And even though obviously all these films have bled in to the book, I was conscious of not trying to actually properly, you know, rip them off or just steal massive chunks out of them. So I wanted to try to do my own thing.
So the way you've kind of looked at structure and kind of learnt this structure, has it ruined movies forever for you and books forever for you now, because you're forever looking for those beats?
Well, in some ways it means I haven't got an off switch. You know, I've been a movie critic for 15-ish years, and before that I was studying film at university. So the sort of like analysis component of watching anything is always playing in my mind, and it's very difficult to turn it off unless something is just like exceptional or very weird. So in some ways I did used to find it a bit like, oh, I can't watch anything now without engaging the analytic part of my brain. But in other ways, I actually quite like it. I quite like I like picking up on stuff, and I like picking things apart and trying to understand what makes them tick. Like, I think storytelling is such a craft and such a puzzle. And when somebody does it really well, I want to know how and why we think it's good. You know, I always think, this is just like complete brain fart, but I often think, what if aliens came down and watched our stories? Would they get the same emotional response? Like, would they just think, what the hell is all of this? Would they understand like the concept of fantasy and make-believe and emotional relationships? Or would they just be completely baffled by it all?
Yeah, and would they kind of, like you say, appreciate the structure and have that emotional response at the end of it?
Can you imagine if aliens were like, well, that's structurally unsound? Yeah. No.
So speaking about your journalism, obviously you're a critic for the Radio Times and you've been writing about film for a long time. Well, how is journalism different from writing a novel? Has there been times where kind of you have to take your journalist hat off to write your book, or has it been helpful?
It's only really been helpful, I think. It kind of has taught me so many things about writing, about discipline. You know, I started out writing 100 word capsule reviews of films, like really short reviews, which is basically three sentences. How do you sum up an entire experience of watching a film in three sentences? But you know, that's a skill that you can learn. And so, you know, going from writing those tiny little capsule reviews to then writing longer reviews, 800 words, writing features, which are like 2000 words, all these little different things that you write as a journalist, taught me how to write, basically. And I think that whenever I'm writing novels, I still feel ridiculous when I say I write novels. but, you know, I do.
You do?
I do. Yes, I have. Which, yeah. I do still use the journalistic principle of we're paying somebody or someone's paying me to write this piece by the word. I'm getting paid by the word. And so every single word really has to earn its place in this article. And I think the same applies to a book. I think that every single page, every single word in a book really does need to sell itself. And if it doesn't, then why the hell is it in there?
Mm.
So yeah, tons of stuff I've learned from journalism that applies seamlessly to novel writing. I can't really think of any ways that it doesn't. Other than you've got to make it all up yourself.
That is very true.
A couple of the articles in the book that I wrote, they're interviews, they're like imagined interviews. And at first you're a bit like, oh, well, I don't really know what they would say. Like, can I not just go and get my transcript? Oh, it doesn't exist because you've made this up.
Yeah, so one detail I absolutely loved about your novel was all these little extra bits you've got between chapters. So you've got reviews, DVD commentary, magazine interviews, you've got all these kind of like script snippets, and it really helps to establish the film as like this cult classic. Was that something you'd always planned to include? Because I guess you had so much fun writing those parts. Or was that something added much later?
They were integral, they were planned right from the beginning. Even my chapter outlines that I'd done, you know, I had a document that was a breakdown of all the chapters, and every single one in between them had interstitial number one, interstitial number two. And I would try to find ways where each article would relate to something that was happening in the next chapter.
Mm.
So there's one interstitial that is the track listing for the soundtrack for the movie. And then in the next chapter, the soundtrack does play it, you know, in the background to the scene. And it was just like a really, it was a fun challenge. I wanted to see how it worked, basically, and if I could make it work. I had done something similar in a previous book where I just had sort of four or five scattered articles throughout, but nothing to the degree of, like, this has 26 chapters. So that means there are 26 found documents as well, which was quite intimidating when my agent would say, oh, I think we need to cut this chapter in half. And I'd be like, oh, that means I need to write another interstitial and run out of ideas.
They were amazing. They were so good.
Oh, thank you.
I feel like if the puppets hadn't come alive, I think you'd be forgiven for thinking the shadow glass really existed. Like, that's how convincing it is.
Yay, that's exactly what I wanted, because the book is also quite heavily inspired by there's these gorgeous hardback collectible books called The Ultimate Guide to Labyrinth, The Ultimate Guide to the Dark Crystal, and they are essentially high-end scrapbooks which take you through the making of those movies. You've got reproductions of handwritten notes by Jim Henson, you've got sort of like artwork, you've got script pages. So that's the one thing that I really did delve into before I started writing The Shadow Glass, was I looked through those books and found inspiration from them. And it just sort of like, it worked thematically as well, because I wanted the reader to almost feel like a fan of The Shadow Glass, which kind of sounds a bit insidious, but I wanted them to really feel like this is a real film and you love it. And that was like a really quick way of doing that and like conveying all that exposition. It was really fun. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed those bits, I think, because, you know, personally, I love reading all like the behind the scenes stuff of films. So it did feel like this film had existed, and that was really, really cleverly done.
Oh, thanks.
So I need to ask you now whether you are basically Bob Corman, the creator of The Shadow Glass. I want to know, your world building is so good. And really, you've got a story within a story. You've got to build the movie world, and you've got to build this world where The Shadow Glass existed. So yeah. Are you someone that has hundreds of little notebooks or scraps of paper with all your kind of like world-building creation on it?
Yes, I do have a notebook. And you can see it. I did a video with a friend on Twitter that shows my book journey, and you can see the notebook right at the start of that video. And it's a notebook that my mum gave to me when I was a teenager. And it was so nice that I never wrote in it. I just sort of kept it. And it's been with me through, I'm going to say, 10, 11 house moves. I've always kept hold of it. And she passed away when I was 21, which made it even more kind of like, if I'm going to use it, it better be for something good. Mm. And something about the timing and the themes of the shadow glass, I was like, do you know what? I think this is the notebook for this. And so I kind of spent a good 6 months before I wrote a single word of the shadow glass, doodling, creating characters, brainstorming sort of like everything from like the merchandise that existed in this world, t-shirts, soundtracks, puppets, cuddly toys, and, you know, things like that, all the way to figuring out the mythology. You know, what does the shadow glass actually do? That took forever. I did write in the book, what does the shadow glass do, underlined 1,000 times, you know, brainstormed a bunch of rubbish until I actually distilled it down to what fitted thematically and emotionally. Mm. So yeah, it was again another way of approaching the story, and yeah, it was really fun, and it just poured out of me. It was one of the, this never really happens, but it's just one of those things where it clearly some latent part, some subterranean part of my brain is just full of love for 80s fantasy. And even though I always knew I kind of loved it, I don't think I knew to what degree until I started doing these notes, and it all just came pouring out of me. It was like an exorcism of the fluffiest variety.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And I wanted to talk about your kind of representation of fans and fandom and kind of nerd culture, really, in the book, because it's done in such a positive, loving way. And I think quite often in fiction and in media in general, geeks and fans get such a bad rap. So was it important to you to write a novel that was like a love letter to these fans and cult movies alongside with them?
Yeah, again, this is such a disappointing answer. It was again just like an instinctive thing where I am a fan. I hang out with fans. I always have. And I've got nothing but affection for people who love, you know, geeky stuff like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Star Wars and Muppets. And there is a joy to it. There's such a joy to it. And yeah, I guess that they're almost like an easy target. Mm. But there are certain films like Galaxy Quest that did fandom beautifully. I think that's one that I did watch last year, having forgotten that it was about fandom. And I was like, oh God, okay. Yeah, that's definitely, that was somewhere lodged in my brain and it's come out in the Shadow Glass. But I do think that fandom has definitely become such an entity of its own. It bears sort of like discussion. You know, fan fiction, enormous. Mm. Conventions, massive. People fly in from all over the world to go to these conventions.
And I guess they've become a lot more mainstream as well. Like you say, they are talked about a lot more.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they've, like, the geeks now rule the world. There was a time when we were sort of like shut away in, well, I wasn't. We were shut away in basements in America, sort of like nerdily drooling over stuff. And now the basement door's been opened. I guess because we're like grown-ups, essentially.
Yeah.
We're grown-ups now. And we're telling people, no, we love this stuff and we're allowed to.
And don't not try to and mock stop it. Us. Yeah.
And places like Forbidden Planet that are like mecca for nerds and geeks, they've made it okay to be a fan, which is lovely.
Yeah. So I want to speak about your book deal and how you got your agent and all the kind of early stages of your journey, because it's such an innovative book and very different. And I wondered, was it a difficult book to kind of pitch for an agent or to sell to get your book deal?
I knew it was kind of an odd sell, but I also knew that there had to be readers out there like me who love the stuff that I love and would enjoy this story. But yeah, I did pitch it around and I did have some interest. I had sort of like requests for full reads and stuff. I had, you know, flat no's, flat rejections. And it turned out that actually the agent that I signed with, it's one of those ridiculous things that you're a bit like, oh, well, that's not really achievable. But it was my agent. I met her at the Young Adult Literary Convention before she was an agent a couple of years ago. And we just had a little chat. And then I bumped into her at a book event a couple of years after that, when she'd become an agent. And I pitched her The Shadow Glass. And I had no idea that she was a massive 80s movies and horror fan. And she was like, yeah, pitch it to me and we'll see. And I did. And she ended up signing me and she ended up being the absolute perfect agent, which I would never have guessed. So it's one of those horrible, like, oh, you had to be right place, right time stories that probably would have filled me with despair trying to get an agent and get a book deal. But I guess the takeaway, if you want to say the takeaway of the story, is that there are so many different ways for this to happen. And all you can really do is just keep trying and put yourself out there. It is disheartening. I'm sure you found the same.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a very different story about how I got my agent. I didn't query in the kind of traditional way. And there are so many different ways. And it, like you say, it's infuriating for people that don't have an agent and they're sitting there thinking, it's all right for you. You've got yours in a different way. But, there's no prescriptive way of getting an agent. And if you have opportunities to network and meet people and submit to competitions or anything like that, that will get yourself noticed and your work noticed, then absolutely, I would say go for it, because you may not get an agent through querying, but you might get them another way. So I see what you mean. It can be frustrating if you're thinking, well, you know, it does, there is a little bit of luck involved, I guess, and a bit of kind of right place, right time. But it happens. So.
Yeah. And also you kind of, I know this is equally crass, but you do almost kind of make your own luck, because if you choose to put yourself out there and you choose to go to these events, like that book event where I met my agent, I wasn't going to go. I wasn't in the mood. Mm. I was going on my own. I knew that I wouldn't know anybody there apart from the authors. And I was like, oh, do you really want to do this? It's winter, it's cold, it's dark. I was like, come on, just go. And actually it was the best thing I could have done. So yeah, I think you're right. It's like, it's so easy for agents and publishers to reject an email because it's faceless, but if they see your name and they remember that they met you, you know, you're halfway through the door then.
Yeah, definitely. So along those lines, if you can you give me your top three tips for anyone working on their novel at the moment?
Okay. only three.
Just to put you on the spot there.
yeah. I think number one is perspective. And this is something I learned really late. And I was kicking myself when I kind of was told this. I'd given The Shadow Glass to a family member to read, and she's an English lit major, so she's studied English, whereas I am not a trained writer apart from being a journalist. And she sent me an email, a great long email, talking about perspective, and I was like, oh my god, you're so right. I'm like, how have I missed this? And what she basically said was that a story is interesting and engaging because you're seeing it through the very unique perspective of the main character or characters. So what is that perspective, and how can you adhere to it sort of absolutely to the nth degree? And it's tough. There are different ways you can do it. You know, there's different sort of narrative ways of doing it. Obviously there's like prose, description, dialogue, reactions, all that kind of stuff. And you can mix them all up. But I do really now think perspective is number one, really is. Because it gives you your in into the story, and it makes that story utterly unique to that character and to the readers, I think. Number two is setting, which I think Ali Wilkes also said.
Yes, on, she did, yeah.
yeah. I really think setting, I can't really break a story until I know the setting, because it's such a cliche to say it's a character, but it is. It really is a character. It for me, like we were talking about the idea of a movie playing in your mind, if I can't see the scene, I can't write it. If I haven't got an immediate snapshot in my mind, it's basically impossible to write it. So I need to have a very specific idea of the town they're in or the house they're in, because it makes it easier to, what's it called? What do they call it? They call it blocking in filmmaking, where you block a shot. So you map out basically where the character is in relation to everything else in the world. So I think setting is a big one. So that's number two. And number three is figure out what your story is actually saying. You've got the plot, which is stuff that happens, but what's the theme, I guess? Like, theme is big, I think. And what are you trying to convey with this story? So even though on the surface The Shadow Glass is about puppets going on a quest, you know, fun times, underneath all of that, it is, like you said, it is a father-son story. It's also a story about failure or perceived failure. It's also about fandom. And I don't know if you need to know exactly what you're saying, but I think there needs to be a sense of the philosophy. Like, reviewers who've reviewed The Shadow Glass, a lot of them are sort of hugely intelligent and insightful reviews where people have picked up on stuff in the book, but they've made it sound way more impressive than anything that I was trying to do. But I do still think that you need to have a general idea of what you're trying to say, and you can refine it over numerous drafts. You don't need to know immediately. I think often you can have a general idea for a story, and then the story does start to tell you what it's actually about, which sounds bonkers, but is kind of true, I think.
So that's you've reminded me of a moment in your novel where you've got a blog post that was written by Bob, where he says basically how the journey of the story is the important part rather than the big climaxes or the set pieces. And that is what I'm getting from you there with your kind of think of the theme, think of the kind of emotions that you want the reader to feel. That seems to be your advice there.
Yeah. Well, that I wrote that blog post because I was like, oh God, I'm coming up to the big finish. I better just warn people that, you know, if it's not the best ending you've ever read, it's okay, because we've been on a journey. It's like me trying to have a conversation with
your disclaimer. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think I originally wrote, I think it was slightly different originally. My first draft of that was, when endings are good, boy, that's something to write home about. And that suddenly felt really egotistical, like I was saying, guys, this is going to be good. And that's not what I intended at all. So,
and you were putting the pressure on yourself there.
Exactly. So you can always go back and refine what you're actually trying to say.
So we've talked movies. Can you think of any book comparisons now that readers who maybe are thinking of what to read next, and they can see your title and think, oh, it's like that, and I enjoyed that, so I'll enjoy The Shadowglass. What are your kind of comp titles?
The big one for me the whole way through was Ready Player One, which is more of a hard sci-fi kind of read. But in terms of the 80s feeling, the nostalgia, the kind of Easter eggs and the quest, that was very much a touchstone, and I love that book. It's fantastic. The anything by Grady Hendrix, I love, and I would die happy to be compared to Grady Hendrix. I'm not going to do it myself. I'm just going to put that name out there and let you guys decide. And my agent came up with, when my agent pitched it out, she said it was like Dark Crystal meets About a Boy by Nick Hornby.
Okay.
And that hadn't, I'm not in any way literary, but when she said that, I was like, yes, I could see
that. I do kind of see that, actually. Now you said it, I would never have put that out there, but I can kind of see it. Finally, I'm just wondering what you're working on next. Are you writing anything new at the moment? And can you give us a little teaser about what it might be about?
I've finished my next, so Shadowglass was my adult debut, so I finished my next adult book, not to be confused with adult entertainment. It is an age genre, not a description of content. So I finished that, and that is very much in the horror camp. Like Shadowglass is fantasy with bits of horror, and the new book is pretty much pure horror. Similarly movie themed, no puppets this time. So that's finished. And I'm about to embark on Camp NaNoWriMo, which is the April edition, basically, of National Novel Writing Month. I always want to say Naval. It's like National Naval Gazing Month.
It might be that if you get stuck.
Yeah, exactly. I've just basically killed myself plotting out a new book just so that when I do tackle NaNoWriMo, I'll always have something to write when I sit down. So,
well, best of luck with NaNoWriMo in April. And congratulations on The Shadowglass. I hope it goes really well.
Thank you so much. I'm really thrilled that you enjoyed it. And I've started your book and I'm loving it.
Oh, thank you so much.
So I cannot wait to get more into it. It's so, oh my God, it's so atmospheric and sort of unnerving.
Thank you. That's the vibes I was going for. So thanks very much.
You nailed it.
Yay. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Josh. It's been great to talk to you.
Thanks, Chloe.
That was Josh Winning talking about his fantasy novel, The Shadowglass, which is out now and available to buy. Before I go, let me just tell you about two events I've got coming up where I'm hosting this podcast, Confessions of a Debut Novelist, live. First, I'm going to be talking to three authors at the Being a Writer Festival, hosted by the Literary Consultancy, on June the 28th. Then on July the 22nd, I'm going to be talking to Louise Morrish about her historical novel at Jericho Writers Summer Festival. Both of these events are virtual, so you can join anywhere in the world and even ask questions. And if you're interested in hearing me talk in person about my novel, The Sea Women, I'll be at the Margate Bookie on Thursday the 2nd of June. Tickets for all these events are available to buy, and I'll put all the details in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening, and if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.